From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. They've been together singing gospel, soul, and rhythm and blues for 20 years. After 2 decades of playing bars and club dates, they have their first album. After hearing it, no one understands why it took so long. On today's Fresh Air, a concert with the Holmes Brothers. Also, Jay Landsman on Making a Revolution Above and Below the Belt. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording from the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And TV critic David Bianculli previews a new telemovie on the bombing of Hiroshima. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Accounts from Port of Spain, Trinidad, now agree that Muslim extremists have freed all 43 hostages seized in their 6-day coup attempt. 120 rebels are reported to be in custody, and the government says they'll be charged with taking part in the rebellion. A government spokesman said there will be no changes in the government of Prime Minister Arthur Robinson. Robinson was held and wounded by the rebels, who charged that his government was corrupt and demanded his resignation. The rebel leader, Abu Bakr, is among those in custody. Republican congressional leaders say President Bush will start getting tough on Democratic lawmakers if they don't present a budget-cutting proposal soon, NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
After a breakfast meeting this morning with the president, Republican leaders said President Bush would wait another 48 hours for the Democrats to put a tax increase plan on the table. House Minority Whip Newt Gingrich said, so far the budget talks have failed.
I think that the first phase of the summit has collapsed. I think the president is committed to trying to resurrect it in September, and I'm willing to work with him to do that. But I think that I don't see any evidence of the Democrats negotiating in good faith.
However, White House spokesman Roman Papaduk struck a more conciliatory note, saying there is no 48-hour deadline and that the president still hopes to resolve the budget impasse. Democratic leaders say they do not want to present a tax plan before the August recess. If there is no agreement by October 1st, $100 billion in automatic budget cuts will begin taking effect. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Officials of the Resolution Trust Corporation, in charge of the savings and loan cleanup, said today that they'll hold an auction November 15th. It's an attempt to sell off about $300 million worth of property, real estate the government has taken over from failed SNLs. NPR's John Idstey reports.
The auction will be staged at the Dallas Market Center in Dallas, Texas, but it will also be beamed by satellite to London and Tokyo and to 9 other locations around the U.S. Interested parties will be able to bid from those locations on properties including these, described by the RTC's John Carlson.
We have a golf course. It's an 18-hole golf course, the King's Crossing Golf Course, located in Corpus Christi, Texas. The Western Savings Corporate Center, located in Phoenix, Arizona, which it's just a very, very beautiful building that housed the former Western Savings and Loan.
Descriptions of all the properties will be available from the RTC in Washington prior to the auction. Officials said the real estate in the auction will be some of the best the government now owns. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
Stock prices fell slightly today on Wall Street as the government's index of leading economic indicators showed more signs of sluggish growth. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 6 points to close at 2,899.25. Declines edged advances in active trading of 177 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I was auditioning some new records a few weeks ago, and nothing was making much of an impression one way or another, until I put on a new CD by a group I never heard of called the Holmes Brothers. It had me immediately. The sound of classic soul and gospel without nostalgia. I knew I wanted to play their record for you, but I'm not going to. Instead, we've brought the Holmes Brothers to Fresh Air for a concert. First, a little bit about them. They've been singing together for about 20 years, mostly in bars and clubs around New York. But they didn't get much notice until now with their first record, In the Spirit. The Holmes Brothers are Wendell and Sherman Holmes, originally from Christchurch, Virginia, and Popsy Dixon, no relation, but also from Virginia. We'll hear Wendell on guitar, Sherman on bass, Popsy Dixon on drums. Welcome to all of you.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
You want to start with a song?
Sure.
Please don't. after all. Darling, please don't hurt me. Come on back where you belong. Darling, when no one cares, you understand me.
That's terrific. I think the obvious place to start here is, how come we haven't heard of you before? Where have you guys been?
Oh, man, mostly in the New York area, the tri-state area, you know, playing around the bars and clubs, private parties and stuff. We like old wine. We just become better, get older, and more mellow.
Well, how do you feel about it having taken this long for you to have a record?
Well, I feel blessed at this age. And, still pinching myself to see if I'm awake.
Who are some of the people you've each played with in addition to playing with each other, people who we've known?
Well, we played with Jimmy Jones, who of handyman fame. And we worked in clubs where we backed a lot of shows with people like Curtis Mayfield and Impressions and name some other fellas, Robert Harrison.
Jerry Butler. I used to be with Inez Fox at one time. She had a record called
Mockingbird.
Right. I was with her, Inez and Charlie Fox. And just a lot of black artists that we played with back in the 60s and 70s.
The kind of singing that you do not only comes out of soul, but it comes out of gospel music, too.
Absolutely.
And you sing gospel as well as soul music. Can I ask you to do a gospel song for us?
Oh, sure. Why not? Why not? Say, do Lord, do Lord, Lord, help me. Do Lord, do Lord, Lord, help me. Do Lord, Lord, help me. Do Lord, remember me. Hey, when I am all alone, Lord, remember me. When I'm all alone, Lord, remember me. When I'm all alone, Lord, Lord, remember me. Do Lord, remember me.
We've got the Holmes Brothers in concert, and we're hearing Wendell Holmes on guitar, Sherman Holmes on bass, and Popsy Dixon on drums. Popsy's the member of the Holmes Brothers who isn't really a Holmes brother. Popsy, how do you feel about that?
Good.
Now, did you all come up from the church? Did you all sing in church or hear music in church a lot before? I mean, when you were young?
Kind of. Yes, we did. We used to... We heard a lot of our background is from the church, but also the blues, country and western. I would say it's a good mix of all three, really.
Popsy, let me ask you where you grew up and if you heard a lot of church music when you were young.
Well, I grew up, yes, I heard quite a bit. That was my basic thing. Don't go to church, you don't go out to play. So I had no choice but to go.
Did you sing in church?
Yes, I did.
Did you sing in falsetto in church?
No.
When did you start? I want you to do a song next that shows off your falsetto. When did you start singing in falsetto?
Well, later during the years. I started practicing doing it. I've been doing it ever since.
I always wonder how somebody knows they have a good falsetto voice. Like, what makes you start doing it?
I just tried it, and it came out. And I've been just keep working at it.
Who did you hear that made you think I want to sing like that?
I used to listen to Smokey Robinson a lot, too.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, let's hear another song. This is the Holmes Brothers. They have a new record. It's their first album called In the Spirit. It's on Rounder Records.
When something is wrong with my baby, with my baby, yeah. Something is wrong, baby.
with me. If I know, baby, I know. I know that my baby's worried. Then I'll still feel that same old misery. We've been through, baby. Oh, baby, so much together. And we've been as one, baby, baby. And that's what makes it better. When something is wrong with my baby, something is wrong with me. Come on, Brother Popsy.
What can you say about that? That is just great. That was Wendell kicking off the vocals, Popsy Dixon doing the falsetto singing, and great performance. Who originally recorded that song?
That was Sam and Dave.
Sam and Dave. Yeah. So how long? You've been singing that one a long time.
We've been singing that one for, let me see, at least 20 years.
We've got it down pretty well. Let's take a short break, okay. And then more of our concert with the Holmes Brothers. This is Fresh Air. back with the Holmes Brothers, a concert on Fresh Air, and they have a new record called In the Spirit on Rounder Records, and we've got Wendell on guitar, Sherman on bass, Popsy Dixon on drums. Wendell and Sherman are the Holmes Brothers. Popsy Dixon is no relation, but they've been playing together off and on for the better part of 20 years. How about a Jimmy Reed song? It's a Jimmy Reed song you do on your new record.
Okay, sounds good to me.
Brothers performing on Fresh Air. Tell me, who's the audience now for soul music and rhythm and blues and the gospel that you do?
Well, the audience is basically young, white,
yuppies,
and middle class, I guess.
And isn't that ironic? I mean, you know, the audience, I don't know, it seems that so often black musicians are the creators of a kind of music, and then a new music comes in style, and it ends up being often like white listeners who end up listening to it later. I don't know I'm getting at here, but how do you feel about that? That there's more of a white than a black audience for the music that you do?
I don't mind. I think that Maybe the black people are trying to forget the blues.
What about soul music, though? I mean, I understand, like, the blues had memories of the South and things that people tried to get away from, whatever. Right. Well, soul music, you can't say that about.
Well,
I don't know. You know, that's a good question that you pose, because it bothers me also. I don't, you know, my people, they don't really support us like I would like for them to do.
But I think that the media... I think that the media helps determine what people listen to.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, what they are bombarded with imprints, I guess. And there they are.
So they
have a new music, sort of what they call rap, which I'm completely out of touch with, but maybe it's a generation gap.
I'm sure that has something to do with it, generation, you know. Is there a soul music circuit to travel on now?
Oh, it is, yeah, it is.
What is the circuit?
Well, it's a lot of clubs, you know, in different cities that have soul music. And you get on, it's like you say, on a circuit, and it's from city to city. It's mostly white, middle-class clubs, I think.
So is that the circuit you've been playing?
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of festivals and clubs.
Mm-hmm. And how is your new record changing your life now?
Well, it affords us the opportunity to have more material things in life, you know, somewhat.
Were there hard years, you know, in the past 20 years making
the
go of it? Uh-huh.
Of course, there were a lot of hard years, but it was all good. It was all good.
Well, I think that might have been hard in music, but I don't think it was really that hard. I mean, we did pretty well. I mean, as life goes.
Okay. Well, I wish you the best with the new record and with all the recognition that you're getting now. And I really thank you enormously for the concert. It was great fun.
Oh, thank
really
you.
Really like your singing and playing. Wonderful to have you all here. And the Holmes brothers, again, are Wendell Holmes on guitar, Sherman Holmes on bass, Popsy Dixon on drums. They all sing... most of the leads we heard today were done by Wendell and Popsy Dixon. And let me ask you to play us out with something.
Okay.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album from the Boston Symphony Orchestra, a recording that Lloyd says shows the BSO does some of their best work when music director Seiji Ozawa is not on the podium. Also, Jay Landsman on fulfilling his goal of combining business and pleasure. His journal Neurotica published early work by some of the beat writers. His nightclub featured performers like Lenny Bruce and Nichols and May. And in less than a week, it will be the 45th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. TV critic David Bianculli previews a new telemovie that dramatizes the bombing and its aftermath. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Trinidad, a hostage crisis has ended, with the gunman holding the island's parliament building releasing the final seven captives. And as darkness fell, the last of the gunmen surrendered to security forces. NPR's Alan Tomlinson in Port of Spain has more on the story.
The hostages were released in two stages. First, at the island's television station, where the largest group of 27 had been held. Later, at Trinidad's parliament building, where 17 more hostages, including seven cabinet ministers, had to wait until darkness was falling before their six-day ordeal ended. After the hostages came their captors, dozens of Muslim gunmen, members of a small local sect, who failed in an attempt to topple Prime Minister Ray Robinson on Friday. Robinson himself was freed 24 hours earlier with a gunshot wound in his leg. The leader of the gunmen, Imam Abu Bakr, was the first to give up. He laid down his gun outside the TV station and stood aside in pouring rain for 2 hours as his disciples filed past him, laying down their weapons at his feet. "Allah is the greatest," he shouted as he boarded a bus to be taken into military custody. In Port of Spain, Trinidad, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
Medical researchers say that they have found the first effective treatment for hepatitis B, a liver infection that's common worldwide. A report in today's New England Journal of Medicine concludes that the genetically engineered drug interferon appears to help some people with this chronic infection. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Hepatitis B is a liver infection common in the developing world and among many of the same people in this country who are at risk for AIDS. Most people fight off the virus without medical help, but some develop a chronic infection. That can lead to cirrhosis or sometimes liver cancer, and until now, no drug treatment has worked against the infection. But researchers today report that interferon alpha can help some of the people with chronic hepatitis B infections. A study of 169 people found that interferon alpha helped in about a third of those cases. The drug sometimes has side effects, including nausea and hair loss, so medical experts say it would not be a good idea to give this drug to everyone with hepatitis B. And the people hardest hit by hepatitis in the developing world will be hard-pressed to buy this expensive genetically engineered drug. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
Five countries in Europe meeting for the first time as a new regional alliance have agreed to improve political and economic cooperation. The leaders of Italy, Austria, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Yugoslavia made a number of agreements aimed at strengthening democracy and aiding economic development in Eastern and Central Europe. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 6 points to close at 2,899.25, volume 177 million shares.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, we talk with Jay Landsman about Neurotica and the Nervous Set. But first, some of Ravel's most familiar and sexiest music was written for the ballet Daphnis and Chloe. The score is also his most ambitious. Daphnis and Chloe was commissioned for the Ballet Russe, and in 1912, Nijinsky premiered the role of Daphnis. There's a new recording of the ballet by the Boston Symphony Orchestra with guest conductor Bernard Haitink. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Haitink coaxes one of the best performances out of the orchestra he's heard in a while.
For a quarter of a century, from 1924 to 1946, the Boston Symphony, under the direction of Serge Koussevitzky, was often regarded, perhaps vying with the New York Philharmonic, as the greatest American orchestra. Koussevitzky commissioned or premiered an impressive number of masterpieces, from Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms to Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra. He was devoted to American composers, and he founded the Berkshire Music Center at Tanglewood. Few American orchestras since that time have had music directors who are both important musicians and cultural leaders. In 17 years with the BSO, Seiji Ozawa has been neither. He's led some well-played, but too often shallow and unstylish performances, and very few great ones. It's guest conductors like Klaus Tennstedt, Claudio Abbado, Pierre Boulez, or some visiting Russians like Gennady Rozhdestvensky or Yuri Tamirkanov, who galvanized the orchestra. Lately, the guest who's made the BSO sound like a great ensemble again is Bernard Haitink, the Dutch conductor who is now in charge of London's Royal Opera House at Covent Garden. His performance with the BSO of Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe last year was one of the orchestra's technical high points. And their new Philips recording may be the first in BSO history, not counting the Boston Pops, of course, to hit the charts. Here's how a great orchestra sounds in the climactic Dawn Passage. The Tanglewood Festival chorus assists. Ravel's crucial solo flute is played by Dorio Anthony Dwyer. 39 years ago, she became the first woman to hold a major chair in an American symphony orchestra. She's just retired from the BSO to pursue a solo career. Daphnis and Chloe is the theme music for almost as many movies as Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet. Haitink sweeps away years of accumulated hyperbole and sticks closer than most conductors to the score as Ravel wrote it. On the other hand, it is ballet music. It tells a love story about a boy and girl in love, rejected suitors, evil pirates, beneficent, rescuing deities. For all the virtues of this performance, its undeniable brilliance and admirable restraint, I find it a little antiseptic, a little too much the sonic spectacular with a metronome for a heart. There isn't much personality or real sexiness in the phrasing, or a sense that where it's all going is more important than where it is at any luscious individual moment. There's an element of slickness in the music itself that a truly inspired conductor can get under or inside of. Haitink sees only what's on the surface, but he gets the players to perform with unusual precision and conviction. They may not show much affection for this music, but they sure know how good it makes them sound.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new Philips recording of Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. It dates back to an article about Cafe Society, published in Fortune magazine in the late 30s. There was a photograph of an elegant couple in a nightclub with the caption, "They want to be amused." Jay Landsman says when he read that, he knew what he wanted to do with his life, go into the business of amusing the chronically bored. So in the late 40s, Landsman set about combining business and pleasure. He became part owner of a hip night spot in St. Louis, then opened his own nightclub where those looking for something out of the mainstream could see performers like Lenny Bruce, Nichols and May, and the Smothers Brothers. Landsman also published a literary journal called Neurotica, where you could find the early works of writers like Allen Ginsberg, Marshall McLuhan, and John Cleland Holmes. There's a new paperback edition of Landsman's memoir, Rebel Without Applause. I spoke to him from the NPR Bureau in London. He's lived in London since the mid-60s. He described the atmosphere he created in his clubs.
I started Little Bohemia on the waterfront of St. Louis by the banks of the river. And it was a sort of an artist's place that displayed paintings from local artists. And you sold drinks. It was the first time a club ever sold drinks and had paintings on the wall, other than cutouts from the Police Gazette. And so that was my first attempt at it. It was a very, very successful attempt at it. And then I went on to do the next club I did was the Crystal Palace, which was a small boite in a very unattractive part of town. And we made it into a little gem of a club, and we had just a lot of fun. It was a permanent party.
Now, you also edited a journal called Neurotica.
Yes.
Which you described as a literary explosion and defense of the problems and personalities that in our culture are defined as neurotic. Why was neurosis the focus of a literary magazine for you?
Well, there were a lot of literary people. There was a time when all the activity, everything was under analysis, and particularly the literary personalities of 19th century, 20th century, and the criticism seemed to center around their psychoanalytic interpretation of why they wrote this and what they were really saying. And that's why Neurotica was interested in the literary aspect of it.
You wrote that you thought neurotic culture was actually
In those days, neurotic didn't have the same connotation that it does today. If you weren't neurotic in 1948 or 1950 in America, you didn't find any friends. I mean, it was a very lonely life not to be neurotic. Neurotic was a very hip thing to be in those days. But the shift of as we got to know better about the neurotic personality, we began to understand it a little better. It ceased to be as attractive as it once was.
When you were editing Neurotica, one of the writers you published was John Cleland Holmes, and you say that the piece of his that you printed, you think that it was the first piece of published fiction to use the language of the hipster. Yet at the same time, you were really alienated by Kerouac and Ginsberg. It seems you were really...
No, I wasn't alienated. No, that's not true. I wasn't alienated. I was bored by them.
Uh-huh.
Kerouac was... wit was not one of his favorite qualities, nor Ginsberg either. Ginsberg I had to ward off because, I mean, he used to come up to me with his journals and say to print this and print that and have a look at them. I never even looked at any of them because I knew he was a wacko back then. And so it was, they were really nothing in the scene at that time, and nobody thought they'd ever amount to anything. But then look at that. Here I am in Islington, and they're myths. So how do you figure that?
It seems to me you were so in the middle.
Bitter?
Well, no, that you were so in the middle. You know, on the one hand, you saw yourself as being very anti-establishment and creating these hip joints for the rich. On the other hand, you were really alienated or bored by, as you put it, by you know, the leading beat writers.
People, Yeah, beat writers were very boring, and beat writers, their contribution to American literary culture has been very limited. I mean, Kerouac is published in 27 languages, and his books still sell. Ginsberg is the subject of a 1,200-page biography and all that. That's all very nice, but what did they really contribute to the cultural to the understanding of the scene? Very little. Very little. Negative.
Well, you're entitled to your opinion.
yes, I am.
You wrote a Broadway show called The Nervous Set, based on your novel of the same name, and it had music by Tommy Wolfe, lyrics by your wife, Fran Lansman. You describe it as characterizing the intellectual life of the time. What was it you wanted to show in the story?
Well, I wanted to send them up, mostly. It was all about Kerouac and Ginsberg and those people, and I wanted to show that the beat generation that the media had grabbed onto from about 1957 to 1959 was, you know, just a media event. It had no significance and no meaning, and it just was, you know, just a fake revolt. That's what the beat generation was all about. It was just all completely fake. And what Kerouac and Ginsberg and Corso and all those people did is they just said a lot of nasty words, and they put together a thing. Although I will want to say this in defense of Ginsberg. He did write two great poems. One of them was Howl and the other was Kaddish, and I respect him for that. But I don't respect him now and for what he's done and the way he's handled things throughout his life.
In the original cast, Larry Hagman played the character based on Kerouac.
Yes. And he did it in a Southern voice that he uses now in JR. You know, Kerouac was with me when that opened up on when our show opened up on Broadway. I had a hard time getting him into the theater because he was so drunk. And then finally, when he got into the theater and the curtain came up and the show started, he went right to sleep. And he didn't wake up until there was a line on it that said in one of the songs in Fun Life, Shakespeare was a hack, so we read Kerouac. He woke up as the mention of his name, and he turned to me and he said, "Good show, Jay," and went back to sleep. He didn't come back for the second act, though.
You're a pretty self-made guy in some ways, right? I mean, you even made up your first name.
Yes, I made it up after I read The Great Gatsby. I said, well, that's... Jay's the name for me, and after all, I couldn't be called Irving all my life, could I?
What was wrong with Irving?
What was right about it? Can you imagine me going up to a girl and saying, "May I buy you a drink? My name is Irving." You can't do it. They'd never accept it.
You were creating a life in Bohemia, and part of the life you created was, you know, running these nightclubs. So you had to be a businessman in Bohemia.
Yes,
and I was
true.
Wondering if that ever put you in some awkward positions.
Not many Bohemians ever graduated into the capitalist class. In fact, most Bohemians are anti-capitalist. Well, I wasn't. I wanted to be able to do the things I wanted to do, and in order to do that, I had to play their game. I had to get out and do the things that were required, and still retain the amount of freedom that I enjoyed.
Tell me why you ended up moving to England.
Well, as our reign came to an end in the 60s, about 1964, we realized that satire, which was the basis of my whole experience there in the club, we used to do the plays, and we used to do the reviews, and we used to do the productions, and they were all highly tinged with satire. Well, in 1964, satire had gone out of fashion, and the Vietnam War, inner city blight, and entertaining sing-alongs, well, it just came up, and suddenly I was out of style. And so when I realized that, I left St. Louis, and I left America because it wasn't, I had nothing more to contribute to it, and America had nothing more for me. So I came over to England for a year on a talent tune-up, as the newspaper said at the time, and ended up living here. My children all grew up here, and I've had a good time.
Did you feel more in style in London than you did in America?
Well, I was very happy here at the beginning because England was a place that had always dreamed about. I mean, it was really, it was swinging London, wasn't it, in 1965 suddenly. And I found myself hanging out with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and dinner with the Beatles, and it wasn't all bad.
Another interesting part of the world that you helped create was it was a part of the world that combined an element of bohemianism with wealth and sophistication and glamour. I mean, let's face it, a lot of bohemians were really broke.
Yeah, well, I didn't know any broke bohemians. Most of the bohemians that I knew were rather rich. It's sort of like people who, liberals in New York, you know, who talk about Chile and Paraguay and all those countries that are under dictatorships. You know, they can talk about those people, but they're just what they're called over here, the chattering classes, champagne socialists or champagne liberals. They're really insignificant, and they really haven't got the right idea at all. But that's another question. Let's don't get into that.
So, Jay Landsman, are you living a fun life?
Can I put it to you this way?
Yeah.
I managed to take the sting out of success and put the fun back in failure. I think that's a good one to wrap it up on.
Oh, it's fine. Jay Landsman's memoir, Rebel Without Applause, is published by Paragon House. This is Fun Life from the musical The Nervous Set.
Let's just have fun, let's not be serious. Play it for laughs, let's just be curious. Everybody knows the human race has lost its reason. Let's just talk at close and what we're gonna drink this season. Let's dig the scene and have our fling with it. Because we're young, let's ding-a-ling with it. Let's not fret and fuss, cause all we've got is us. Baby, let's just have fun. Let's just have fun, let's not be serious. Play it for laughs, let's just be curious. We don't give a damn.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, I understand there's been a resolution to the crisis in Trinidad and Tobago.
Terry, the hostage situation in Trinidad is over. The militant Muslim group that captured government officials back on Friday has surrendered. No deals were made, according to the government. Also, closing arguments in the drug and perjury trial of Washington Mayor Marion Barry. The U.S. Senate votes to give up the practice of taking honoraria for speeches. They can now take up to more than $27,000 a year. Senator Robert Byrd said that practice made them seem at times like used car salesmen. Also, a story about coyotes, a new book called Skywater, the story of a journey by a group of coyotes across the Sonoran Desert.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Next Monday, on the 45th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, NBC will show a docudrama about the devastation of the city. TV critic David Bianculli has this review of Hiroshima Out of the Ashes.
Open bomb bay doors. Over target area, 2 degrees right. Axis of attack, 242 and holding.
I have acquired target. Synchronize release point in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
That was only a dry run, with an American B-29 dropping propaganda leaflets on Hiroshima instead of a nuclear bomb. The actual bombing occurs a bit later, after the major characters have been introduced and established, including two schoolchildren who look out of their classroom windows with excitement rather than fear as an American plane approaches.
Look, Yoshi, it's just one B-29.
NBC's Hiroshima Out of the Ashes is based on the stories of actual Hiroshima survivors. The cast includes Max von Sydow as a German missionary, Judd Nelson as an American prisoner of war, and such Asian actors as Pat Morita, Kim Miyori, and young Brady Suratani, who plays Little Yoshi. The best performance, though, comes from Stan Egai, who plays a Japanese physician trying to cope with and understand the horrifying after effects.
Doctor, there are patients in the north alcove. I cannot stop the bleeding. Would you mind?
There is nothing to be done for them. Nothing. They will die. Work with the ones who have some hope.
Which are they?
I don't know.
Producer Robert Greenwald, who did The Burning Bed, and director Peter Werner, who did LBJ the early years, structure this telemovie like ABC structured The Day After. Only this drama is based on fact, not fantasy. And Hiroshima Out of the Ashes could make you cry, where The Day After was so bad it was laughable. It's surprising, though, that this NBC telemovie is less powerful and graphic than such fictional after-the-bomb dramas as Testament and Threads. Maybe it's because actual photographs and newsreel footage from Hiroshima are so unforgettably haunting that no piece of make-believe, however well-made or well-intentioned, can approach the grim reality.
David Bianculli is TV critic for The New York Post. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Dan Buskirk and Lisa McCullough. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the man behind movies like The Little Shop of Horrors, The Wild Angels, Attack of the Crab Monster, and The Pit and the Pendulum. Roger Corman talks with us about making movies quick, cheap, and successful. Also, William Taubman on a new biography of Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.